For me, it's like breathing.
Lutheran.
I am.
Lutheran. Lutheran.
Welcome to the beautiful campus of LCMSU, everyone. I'm your host.
I am the one who knocks.
Chancellor, Pastor Boss.
Jesus. And that's really what
me and
my friends
are
all about.
Welcome back today in the student union, Pastor Trevor Sutton. How are you doing today, Trevor?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing?
I am doing, as I said last time, fantabulous. Trying to create a new word here.
You're going to get it.
Everyone, Pastor Sutton is Associate Pastor of St. Luke Lutheran Church in Haslett, Michigan, just kind of outside Lansing. Author of a new release from CPH called Being Lutheran, and he's also a digital rhetoric college student, master's level student at Michigan State University. Go Sparty.
There you go.
It's great to have you once again. Last week on the show, we kind of gave a little bit of an introduction to the book, why you wrote it, talked about all sorts of things about that. We kind of want to focus in today, as you know, this is a show about college students and for college students. We're going to kind of hone in on a couple of chapters that kind of really speak, I think, to a lot of the issues that we face on college. And so today we're going to talk about the whole notion of confusion, the confusion that we have in our world and the academic square. But first, Trevor, if you could, just for the sake of those that maybe didn't get to hear last week, what is this book about? Give us a little 1 or 2 minute kind of a thumbnail overview of the book and why you wrote it and what it's really all about.
Yeah, so the book is Being Lutheran, and I had to wrestle with what does it mean to be Lutheran, and how is that different than thinking Lutheran thoughts or acting in a Lutheran way? What does it mean to kind of bring those together and to have right doctrine, have Lutheran theology, but then actually own that and live it out and make that manifest, you know, each and every day of the week. So that's kind of the whole premise of the book is what does it mean to bring these together? As you look at the book as a whole, it does a couple different things. It first of all, it anchors everything in Jesus, recognizing that being Lutheran is about following Jesus, not following Martin Luther. So every chapter takes a look at something that Jesus taught, something that Jesus fought for, something that Jesus preached about that he owned in some way, a truth of Jesus. And then it goes to seeing how this truth was maybe lost or confused or obscured throughout church history, how Luther and other reformers, Lutheran reformers, kind of brought this back and owned this in a new way. And then finally it looks at what does it look like for you to do this? What does this look like in your own daily experience on campus, in the workplace, with your family, whatever. So that's kind of every chapter, but the book is divided in two broad sections. The first 5 chapters are about what do we push against? What do we resist? What are we reacting against? For instance, Lutherans are not comfortable with a gospel that is exclusive or closed or only accessible for some people, closed by a language barrier or lack of proclamation of the gospel, something like that. So we resist that and we push against it. The second half of the book is then about what do we cherish? What are the things that we cling to that really get our heart kind of thumping? And an example of that is new life in Christ, that we are first and foremost people that we just love to talk about how Jesus has made us new, not by anything we've done or brought to the table, but simply by God's grace shown to us on the cross. So that's what the book is. It's what we push against, what we cherish, and how we bring that all together in thought and action.
That is fantastic. And, it's actually an incredible concept because it's for our college students. They show up on a college campus. I've often explained that it's kind of like, you know, going to the moon. It's a completely different place. Everything's confusing. Nobody knows what they believe and why. except maybe the profs, and maybe they don't even know. And it's almost like boot camp where they're trying to break you down and recreate you to self-identify in all sorts of various ways. In fact, that's all we see on campus anymore is all this talk of self-identification and everybody trying to identify with every cause and every group. And yet there's really no core, you know, knowledge and substance to what anybody really believes. And it's all emotive, and it's a very confusing place for our college students. But you start your chapter on called Confused, with quoting 1 Corinthians 14:33, "For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace." And you kind of are talking about this postmodern milieu that we have in our academic context and our intellectual climate today. And you have this kind of this great analogy of how you explain that. Why don't you fill us in on that?
So the analogy that I use is kind of an antiquated practice of bloodletting. And maybe folks are familiar with bloodletting, maybe they're not. But this was really sort of the gold standard in medicine for many, many, many generations. And the idea behind bloodletting was that you have different levels of fluids in your body, blood being one of them, but also bile and phlegm and all these different things. And if those levels, those fluids, get out of whack, out of balance, then it shows itself in health issues. And so the idea of bloodletting was that if your levels are out of whack, you've got to let some blood out, pour some blood out, open a vein, and bring those levels back into where they need to be. And I think the most famous example that many folks are familiar with is George Washington, where he had a throat infection, and as was the practice of many people in that day, he went to see his doctor, or else a barber would often do bloodletting as well, and take some blood out and take some more blood out. And what happened was that process is, removing all this blood kind of hastened his death. It made the infection worse and made his body anemic and unable to fight this infection. And then the jump that I make is really post-modernity. What that is we're afraid of what happened in modernity. We're afraid of
what is making, what was modernity?
Yeah, so modernity, and there's maybe 10 different ways to answer that, but really the easiest way to kind of explain that is modernity says that we have the opportunity, the ability to have a true objective observation. And from that true objective observation, we can then make very, very broad sweeping claims about the world. So one of the kind of greatest train wrecks of modernity would be the Holocaust. And the thought was, we have this idea of eugenics, that there is such thing as a perfect race. We know this objectively, and we're going to take this perfect race, and we're going to make a sweeping claim about it, and we're going to kill everyone who's not part of this race. And so that horrific event and that horrific conclusion really caused a lot of people to say, whoa, hit the brakes. Anything that is a broad sweeping claim must be false, must be wrong, because you don't have the knowledge that you think you have. You don't actually know what you think you know. All you can really say are small little truth claims is what people often talk about, or meaning making, or constructing knowledge, or kind of postmodern ideas. And the whole idea is that we sort of we can't trust any knowledge that somebody claims to have. So we sort of bleed a pint here, bleed a pint there, bleed a pint here, until ultimately all we have is skepticism and incredulous thinking, and we don't trust anything or anyone, and all we do is make little claims about the world. So it's a very confused world, exactly like you said.
Well, and you put it this way very well, and I'll just quote you. "Walk into any university classroom and you will experience this firsthand. Students do not learn in class. They engage in constructivist meaning making. There is no such thing as history. There are just intertextual multivocalities of the past. There's no right interpretation of Romeo and Juliet. There are simply differing and equally valid readings. Truth is out. relativism is king. Now, if that doesn't, Trevor, if that doesn't nail the collegiate experience today, frankly, I don't know what does. I mean, that is what we're dealing with on campus.
I would agree. And in all that, too, though, there is this kind of great irony that really the postmodernist claim of relativism is in itself a sweeping meta-narrative, a broad claim that, you know, you can't know anything, and we know that for certain, which is quite circular and illogical. But
well, and it kind of sounds in a way like, you know, to extend your analogies, it's kind of like the academic climate. We have professors that are vampires that are seeking to drain your blood. No, but it's almost kind of like in a way, there's this attempt, and maybe I'm pushing a little bit too far, to kind of do this bloodletting to the point to where you get anemic and weak. You don't know who you are, what you believe, what you're about. Everything that you've always believed in your life, that you've known, you can't focus on, you can't concentrate. Everything seems out of whack. You're feeling dislocated. You're homesick. You're at college, and your blood is being drained. And as you slowly replenish it, it's who knows what it's going to be replaced with. So I'm going to have a show on professors as vampires.
Yeah, I've never heard of deconstructionism being described as vampire-ish. But
yeah, this is what happens when you extend analogies too far. Case in point.
But I think you're right, and it's so easy though to look at anything and to say, well, here's how I can pick this apart and deconstruct it and break it down. So you can do this with so many different disciplines. So, for instance, my work in rhetoric, you know, we talk a lot about what is good grammar. And you have this idea, well, good grammar is what I learned in third grade. But then you talk to an international student, and the international student learns something totally different as far as what good grammar is in sure. China or somewhere else. You know, and then you kind of say, well, wow, maybe what I thought was good grammar isn't good grammar. And then you get to this point where it's so easy to say, well, then there is no foundation. There is no mooring. There is no anchor. We don't know what good grammar is. And tearing it down is easy. Building it back up, I think, is really difficult.
Sure. No, absolutely. And we, when we lose grammar, I mean, we're pretty much, you know, it's Tower of Babel City for us. We're not going to have a clue as to what to do. And I do think there's a problem with that. There is a problem with that today. People don't know how to. I've often threatened to come up with a program called Dare to Think, because I think we actually need to retrain people how to think, so that they can even make sense of this confusion. But that's for another day. But so here, you've mentioned before, and you mentioned, you know, being a Lutheran is all about Jesus. And so how is today's intellectual climate, this confusing mess, is this any different to Jesus' day, and how did he deal with it?
I think it's so easy to look at history and to think what they lived in was totally different than what we live in. They didn't have the internet, they didn't have smartphones, they didn't have automobiles, you know, and so just their experience and their world was 180 degrees opposite of ours. And I think it's just so false. One of the things I always like to tell people is in King Tut's tomb, they found acne medication. I mean, so this perennial thing of acne.
Now, why would he need that in the afterlife?
Yeah. I'm not sure if the archaeologists have figured out exactly what the deal is with it.
I'm going to go on record right here now. I do not believe that there will be acne in heaven. I'm just saying it right here. I called it.
Christ's restoration is more powerful than even acne.
There you go.
But
anyways.
But the point is that I think we want to say that the world in the past was so different than today. And in fact, it's not. There's nothing new under the sun, right?
Sure.
And so we look at the world that Jesus lived in, the world that Jesus taught in and preached in and lived and breathed. It's really not that different than our world, than even our college campuses today. You know, they didn't have Snapchat and smartphones, maybe, but they were plagued by confusion. And you can see this in the Gospels, that there was all this confusion about this generation or this rabbi or this rabbinical tradition said this, but that contradicts with this one, and that contradicts with this one. And so no rabbi in that day wanted to kind of go out on a limb and speak on their own authority. So they would say, well, it's been said, and it's been said by this person, and it's possible of this. So that was the rabbinical world. But then the Roman world was kind of the same way, that the Romans, whenever they would take over a culture, whenever they take over a new country, they would often kind of keep the language, keep the deities, keep the practices of that culture and kind of absorb it into the greater kind of Greco-Roman culture.
Mm-hmm.
And what ends up happening then is, whether you're Jewish or Roman, the world you're living in is just speculation and confusion and postulation. In Jesus, what we see is the opposite of that. His ability, his willingness, his boldness to speak truth into that confusion, to make a confession that is without equivocation, without, you know, obfuscation. He's absolutely clear. You've heard it said, but I say to you, and I'm always struck, you know, Jesus didn't cite his sources because he was the source. Yeah. Yeah, so he never messed around with MLA citation like every college student.
Wow. No, that's exactly right. So Jesus comes in to all of this mushy gray and just says, boom, here's how it is, guys.
And people were divided by that. They were shocked by that. They liked it on one level. I think people said, you know, what is this teaching with authority? But it was a lightning rod, and it was not a soft, easy teaching either.
No, but that, I mean, the authority, I think almost, I mean, in a cursory way, I think most times the response is, who the heck is this guy showing up that's talking as if he's got the authority to do this? And that seems to be the first layer of like people getting smacked in the face, like with a wet blanket. It's like, wow, where did this come from? And frankly, I mean, don't you think that's kind of missing today? We don't want to speak as those who have authority, but yet we are followers of Christ who have been given his word. His word is the authority, and yet we're afraid, it seems oftentimes, to speak as if it is a black and white thing, as if there is authority.
Certainly, and the key there, though, is that I'm not speaking on my own authority,
right?
When I follow in the teaching of Jesus. So it's not based on where I went to school, what I learned, what my perspective or understanding is. This is the truth of Jesus. And that's where I think it's really liberating, in the sense that if it is based on my authority, well, I've been wrong before. I could be wrong again. If this is based on the authority of Jesus, there's something more there, and something eternal there, and something powerful there. And that's why I would caution us away from speaking authoritatively when it's based on our own authority, and then speaking very boldly and confessing clearly when it's on the authority of Jesus.
Oh, absolutely. And I also don't want to give anybody the false impression that I'm saying, hey, let's go on to campus, stand on a soapbox, thus saith the Lord. You know, there's my dad taught me once the three T's of communication. One, is it true? Two, is it the best time to say it? And three, what's the best tact in doing it? And so you have to be careful how you go about these things. And we don't want to be jerks with speaking in authority. I don't want to give that impression. But, going back a little bit to, I want to hone in on another paragraph. This is an excellent book, by the way. Seriously, everybody should get one or 10 copies of this. In terms of this idea of teaching with authority, you write that different religions and ideologies also coexisted with the Roman Empire. And you mentioned this. Deities from conquered territories were absorbed into religious beliefs. Roman religious beliefs led to thousands of different gods, shrines, and practices. Philosophical schools competed for students. It was a patchwork of different languages, beliefs, and opinions. And I guess I just want to reiterate this. You mentioned this already. But to point out that this is the college campus. There is a lot of spirituality on a college campus. But I always tell the story that First week as a campus pastor, I had a young man show up at the University of Wyoming telling me that he wanted to create his own religion because he'd explored all of them, and he wanted to take the best and most significant parts of each and kind of mash it up into one thing, because then hopefully he could bring everyone together. And it, now, of course, it didn't work very well. I don't think he was very successful at it. He probably gave up. But that is what happens in the midst of this confusion, is that people on, they're searching in this, what does this mean to me, or what do I want it to mean to me, culture, is this idea that we're creating our own truth. Anyways, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because college campuses are very religious places. Young people are seeking for answers, and they can't seem to find anybody that can have any sense of authority that they bring to the topic. And so what are they left to do? They're left to coming up with their own ideas.
And the academic word is kind of bricolage. It's sort of piecemealing little things together, taking a bit from here and a bit from there. The kind of more popular word is remix. And I think we do. We live in a remix culture where it's very commonplace on college campuses to take a little bit of Hindu, a little bit of Islam, a little bit of Christianity type. I mean, just anything, and just take it all together. And I'm gonna do a little bit of karma, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Hope for a little bit of grace, and this is gonna be my remix. And this is the spiritual world I live in, which is just utterly confused. And if you really dig a little deeper, you find it's quite contradictory and impossible.
Now, the next show, we're going to talk about the purpose of maybe how we as our college students can respond to this. But real quick, Luther lived in kind of a similar period too, didn't he? Kind of a period of theological ignorance. How did he deal with it? Are we there again?
It was a time of supreme theological ignorance, in the sense that the majority of church functions, worship, the scriptures, you know, so forth, they were all in Latin. They weren't in the language of the people, the lingua franca. So the majority of people...
Oh, big words, boys and girls. I'm sorry.
I know. You got me going, so now they're all coming out.
It's all right.
But nobody had access to scripture. Nobody really had access to the preaching of the church. So there was that. But then even the church workers of that day, people are shocked to find out that the vast majority of monks and even folks that would preach, not priests that were ordained, but people that had a preaching post at a local church, what they would often do is they'd have one sermon memorized, and they would go sort of from town to town or pulpit to pulpit and preach that one sermon that they knew. But if you polled 10 people during the time of Luther, do you know the Lord's Prayer? I don't know what that number would be, but it wouldn't be more than 50%. And there was just a dreadful lack of knowledge. And so what Luther, what was just amazing, where he kind of reclaimed this teaching of Jesus was, no, you have a clear confession. You know what you can pray because Jesus has taught you what you can pray. And here it is. And here it is in the small catechism, broken down so you know what does this actually mean. An example I talk about in the book is Luther's barber asked him once, how do I pray? And instead of Luther kind of brushing him to the side or telling him, well, you know, just say these 10 words, he actually wrote him a whole kind of pamphlet of here's how you can do it, and let me explain this to you. But again, that wasn't based on Luther's authority of here's how to pray, as written by Martin Luther. It was, here's from the source, Jesus, here's how you pray.
Okay. Yeah. So we have about a minute left here. Let me close by asking you, let me just ask you this. The opposite of confusion is really, the answer is our confession. You said in the book that Jesus puts you upright, right side up in a downside world. So for our college students out there, what is the answer so that they walk into the sea of confusion? What is the answer? What should they do to be able to counteract that? Got about 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, I'll do it quick. The biggest thing is actually knowing what you believe and why you believe it. And the hard part about that is no one's going to really be able to do that work for you. Mm-hmm. You can't have a conversation with someone about your confession of faith and then say, hold on, let me call my pastor and find out what I believe about this. That you actually need to do that work of reading through Scripture, being in Bible study, knowing what your confession of faith is, so that you can have a clear response when someone actually asks you, so wait, you Christians are about just being good people, right? And instead of bumbling through that, you can actually say something that's based in the truth of Jesus. Lutheran.
You can get Pastor Sutton's book at cph.org. College is tough.
It's about Jesus. Lutheran.
Will help.